This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome to the National Museum and to our lovely evening tonight. The evening's going to be in a couple of parts. Basically, we'll have about an hour inside to have a chat about amateur astronomy and particularly about this beautiful telescope behind us. And then we'll head outside to actually do some stargazing. Now, for the next hour, we all have to cross our fingers and hope that the clouds that are passing across decide to pass on. That's right. Exit the vicinity for at least a couple of hours. But I'm pretty hopeful. I think it's looking reasonably good. My name's Kirsten Wainer. I'll just move back a bit. Can everybody hear okay? You sure? Yep? Okay, good. My name's Kirsten Wainer. I'm a senior curator here at the museum, and I'm very pleased to be able to welcome two members of our panel tonight. On the far left is Vince Ford in the marvellous waistcoat, which I believe we have to thank his wife for. yes, taking orders, I'm sure, as we speak.
She never takes orders.
So Vince is an astronomer and worked at Mount Stromlo as an astronomer for some 40 years, correct? Yeah. And now is devoting more of his time to the Canberra Astronomical Society, and we're very thankful to the Society for being able to make the stargazing possible tonight. It's really a wonderful thing. And then Herman Wainer, who is an astronomical engineer, I think you would say, who was at Mount Stromlo for...
Even longer than me.
Longer. We won't be specific. Herman has, over the last several years, been working with the museum as a volunteer to help us conserve and refurbish this 1883 telescope. I should also fess up and say Herman is my father. So if I break into calling him Dad in the middle of it, don't worry too much. We're very keen on our volunteers. We call everybody Dad in here. That's
good. It gets confusing with the women, but...
It does, yes, you know, but strangely they don't seem to object. So why have we got the telescope on display tonight? Well, I think many people here tonight will know that 2009 is the International Year of Astronomy, and declared this year, of course, principally because it's the 600th anniversary since Galileo turned a telescope to the night sky and really began the field of observational astronomy. And, of course, in the process, you know, irritated a lot of people in the church hierarchy. But his legacy, I think, is what we're starting to connect with even tonight, 600 years later.
400.
Okay. So it was a long time.
Galileo's ancestor.
That's right. 200 years ago. I wrote 600.
Also called Galileo.
That's right, yes. His great-great-great-great-grandfather was also very interested in astronomy. Yeah. The museum decided to mark that event and to participate in that in the international year by really launching this particular telescope. This is a telescope that we bought back in 2005. And I have really spent almost the last 4 years working on bringing it back to its working condition round about when it was manufactured. The telescope was manufactured in Dublin, in Ireland, in 1883, and it came out to Australia in 1885. And I might get Herman to talk a little bit about sort of the story about acquiring it. I can begin it to say that we actually just got a phone call out of the blue at the museum. One of our curatorial staff, someone came on the phone and said, I've got this telescope, it hasn't been used for a while, you know, would you be interested in acquiring it? And since I had some interest in astronomy, I said, oh, I'll investigate that one. So we sort of talked to the person who owned the telescope at that stage, and he said, why don't you come and have a look at it? And so myself, David Thorogood, one of our then conservators, and Herman went up to Brisbane to have a look at it. Herman, do you want to tell a little bit about just going up to see it?
Well, we found the telescope in a shipping container. In pieces, of course, not in this as nicely looking as it is now, all tucked away. The tube was fairly well protected in a canvas bag, but other smaller pieces were a bit stored haphazardly. But we looked at it in detail, particularly the objective and other parts of the optics, like eyepieces and so on, And it soon became apparent that a few small pieces were missing, not the objective or the eyepieces, fortunately, but smaller items which one doesn't by necessity need to use the telescope in a fairly semi-professional way. But in the end, these shortcomings and the good sides of it, of course, also were written up and handed to the museum directorate, and they decided eventually to purchase the instrument.
Took a bit of fast talking, that's all.
Perhaps that. I wasn't involved in that bit. But eventually it turned up here at the depository in Mitchell, and Kirsty said, wouldn't I come and have a look at it? And we made a long list then of what should be done to the telescope. It's important to note that the process decided upon was not a restoration of the telescope, but conservation. That is, go back to square one, go back to the time when the telescope was actually purchased and brought out to Australia, and try to get the telescope back into the same perfect, as it were, inverted commas perhaps, condition. And I think looking at it now, and after what we have done to the initial purchase, I think we have succeeded in achieving that. Right down to the coat of paint on the telescope tube, which was meticulously analyzed by spectrographic methods to find out what paint has been used, what was the undercoat and the overcoat, and so on, so on, so on. And apart from the intermediate paint layers, that is, after purchase to the present day, the initial paint coat was established and was replicated, and that is what is on the telescope now. So if the builder for of the telescope, one Thomas Grubb of Dublin, would be able to be around, I think he would be pleased and say, gee, this is the way it was when I shipped it to Australia, and that would be a feather in our cap, I think.
I think that was one of the most common questions we asked ourselves, wasn't it, when we were working on it, is like, now what would Mr. Grubb have done?
That's not what he has said, but what would he have done?
Yes.
And that is because of my age, I got roped in. And please cast your mind back to 1883
That's right.
And see how would they have done this knob or this something or whatever. Difficult job, I tell you. But I think we sort of, with a bit of a wink and a nod, we succeeded.
What amazes me about 1880s telescope builders as your choice, if you wanted an instrument about this sort of size, you had your choice of three manufacturers. There was Grubb in Dublin, there was Slug in Scotland, and there was Crook in London. And lots of people bought a Crook telescope.
Yes, they did indeed.
Yeah.
I should say before we go on, I meant to say at the beginning that we're thinking very much of this evening as an informal chat. So if you have questions, please interrupt. I don't want to keep them all until the end. I will just get you to put your hand up, and we'll bring a microphone around. Leanne will kindly run around with it, just so everybody can hear the question, let alone the answer. And I'll also just let you know that we are recording this evening, so just so you know, your lovely dulcet tones will go down in posterity as part of this evening's events. I thought what we might do is sort of take a little step back to talk about how the telescope came to Australia, which is really a lovely part of my job at the museum as a curator, is when we are offered a new collection, is to try and discover what the history, or what we call the provenance, of that collection is. And I was very lucky when we got offered this particular telescope, because I discovered that a lovely chap called Dr. Wayne Orchiston, who's actually up at Townsville at James Cook University, had very helpfully gone off and written a few papers about the history of amateur astronomy in Australia, and had indeed traced the history of the telescopes that were like this one that came to Australia in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that meant, and he had done that by basically going and sitting in the Mitchell Library up in Sydney and reading through vast reams of correspondence between all the amateur astronomers in Australia who were writing to each other to tell them, you know, oh, I've just bought this absolutely fantastic telescope and it's, you know, at least a bit bigger than yours, and I'm sure, you know, I'll be able to do much more important work.
They're still the same today.
Yes.
It's called aperture fever.
That's right. I've got a bigger aperture than
aperture
yours.
Aperture envy. Yeah.
Well, what we discovered was that this telescope was purchased around 1885 by a chap called William John McDonnell. And we think that Mr. McDonnell may have purchased it directly from Grubb in Dublin via a catalogue. He looked it up in the catalogue and decided what kind of instrument he would like, how big and with what features, and presumably sent off a deposit, I would imagine. Around 1885, the telescope arrived in Australia, and Mr. McDonnell took it to Port Macquarie, where he was living at the time. W.J. McDonnell was a bank manager. He wasn't a professional astronomer by any means. He was a bank manager, and he had been sent to Port Macquarie to head up the Bank of New South Wales, which is now Westpac Bank. I think he must have been quite a keen astronomer, because not only did he add this to a sort of expanding stable of instruments that he had accumulated over that period and in kind of the years leading up to it, but he also built a special purpose observatory in the backyard of the Bank of New South Wales to house this and his other instruments. And if you can look, I don't know if you can see, but if you can see the image up there, that is Mr. McDonnell standing outside his lovely new observatory behind the bank. I do wonder if he was a bit like one of the early governors of Australia, Governor Darling, who was also a very keen astronomer, and came to Australia and in the middle of the 19th century, and a short while later got told off by the Colonial Office because it seemed he was neglecting his administrative duties because he was staying up all night watching the stars. I do wonder if Mr. McDonnell was quite, you know, sort of got a little bit of trouble as well that way. McDonnell kept the telescope for a number of years, around about 10 years, and he did a range of observing programs with it and with other instruments that he had with him. I wonder if, Vince, can you talk a little bit about what amateur astronomers of that time would have been actually doing?
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of an interesting and busy time, because it was a time where astronomy was changing from just sort of noting the positions of stars, which was kind of vital for timekeeping and navigation and so on. And in fact, the state observatories that were set up back in the 19th century, that was their main job, timekeeping and navigation. What the amateurs did was to sort of turn it more into looking at the universe as a whole and trying to figure out how it all worked. And telescopes of this size were used a lot for actually investigating double stars. I mean, a third of all the stars in the sky are at least double. They're not one star, they're two or three stars, sometimes four, up to half a dozen stars, locked together by gravity, sort of waltzing around one another, but to your eyeball, they look like one. Hopefully, if it clears up, we can show you one of these things tonight. So, why do you want to investigate double stars? Well, it's a way of finding out how massive, how heavy stars are. If you can figure out how long it takes them to go around one another, you can figure out the relative masses of them. That was kind of important. The whole business of, you know, what is out there besides stars, mapping the rest of the sky and finding out what these big gas clouds were, the so-called nebulae. In these telescopes, they just show up as fuzzy blobs, clouds, which is what nebula means in Latin, cloud. Turns out what nebulae are the places where stars are being born all the time. Again, if it clears up, out there's a
night tonight.
Finding things, comets, most comets up to the time that a few satellites were launched were discovered by amateurs, and there are a couple of people in this room that have actually discovered comets, I think. I think I saw one of them come in a while ago. Might be outside setting the telescope up. Anyway, there are three or four people in Canberra that have a string of comets after their name, so it's not just guys like John Tebbutt who found the great comet of 1861, back in 1861, obviously.
Or surprisingly,
Tebbutt actually
not
used this telescope.
Later,
yeah, this is one of Tebbutt's telescopes at one stage.
Yep.
So it's a direct tie back to one of the great 19th century amateur astronomers. I don't like that word amateur, I've got to say, because there's really not much difference.
The only thing is, of course, amateur means someone who does it for the love of it.
Yes.
Professionals do it for the love of it too.
and pay for it.
Not a lot worse. Get paid a lot better. Yeah. So, discovering comets. The sunspots. The sunspot cycle is, well, we don't know what sort of effect it really has on the Earth. There's been attempts to sort of tie sunspot cycles to weather, and it's still going on. It looks like there is some effect, but not really sure what yet. Novae and supernovae, stars that just all of a sudden brighten up enormously. Nova, because most of them, before they brighten up, are beyond the limit you can see with your eyeball. And all of a sudden, bing, there's one there. Ah, it's a new star. It's a nova. In Latin, nova's new. So these sort of discoveries were the thing that amateurs were doing through the 19th century and through the 20th century and are still doing today. These days, of course, they do even more than that. We've got a guy in the Canberra Astronomical Society that is producing images of the planets that rival the ones being taken by Hubble, and he's doing it with a telescope with about twice the diameter of this one.
Now, if only we get the Hubble budget for the Canberra Astronomical
Society.
Oh,
indeed. In fact, just before the fire that removed most of the telescopes from the top of Stromlo, those telescopes were being operated most nights by members of the Canberra Astronomical Society, who are providing observers for Stromlo so that us professionals could get on with the business of data analysis rather than spending our time on the cold end of a telescope collecting the data. Amateurs have always been a very, very important sort of backup for the professional.
I think one of the other things, Vince, I was going to say that I found really interesting about McDonald, and which I think is probably a very strong continuation with our evening tonight, is that he, like the other amateur astronomers, were very active in sort of promoting astronomy in public education, and in writing articles to the newspaper to say the government should be giving astronomy more money, and you know, kind of letting people know about what happened when they saw a comet.
And
in
there
the
is,
sky.
Of course, still a small public observatory operating in Port Macquarie.
Yes,
that's probably the oldest operating public observatory in Australia. Very important. I mean, other amateurs have actually funded observatories. James Oddie, the mayor of Ballarat, he made a fair packet out of the gold fields. He was actually the sort of chief of the superintendent of the School of Mines, and so on. He had quite a large observatory at Mount Pleasant in Ballarat. That's still there. But one of the things he did back when at the time of Federation, when it was decided there would be a, for want of a better term, a Commonwealth Observatory in the ACT, he presented the Commonwealth Government with one of these gadgets, 1.5 times the size, a 9-inch diameter lens in it. That Oddie telescope was on Stromlo from 1910 up to the time of the fire, and it was the telescope that from 1970 onwards was the one that we used for school kids and visitors to show them the sky. The last research work on the Oddie was actually done in 1974 when Don Matheson and I used it with a newfangled electronic camera on the back end of it, looking for the remains of supernovae in our galaxy. We also used the twin of this thing, the 6-inch Farnham telescope at Stromlo, with an electronic camera on it. Why? Well, because we could get it for 100% of the time. And the other thing is the optics of it happened to match quite nicely the field size we wanted for that particular survey. One of the girls we had helping on that one of our students, actually fell through the floor one night. The Farnham was up in a little dome on the end of the old Commonwealth Observatory building up there, which has now been rebuilt. The dark room was down below the telescope, and underneath that was the drawing office. And Martha comes racing out of the telescope with a couple of unprocessed photographic plates ready to go down the dark room to process them, and she hit the floorboards that had rotted through. So, thunk, down into the drawing office. and the drawing office was locked and she couldn't get out, and she was stuck there till 9 o'clock the next morning, or 8:30, when some of the drawing office guys appeared for work. Martha was a red-headed Irish lass, and I'm told that the language was... someone should have recorded it. Astronomy is full of little pitfalls, shall we say. But telescopes like this really did help get Australian astronomy on its feet.
Vince, it's interesting you mentioned the Farnham telescope, because it's certainly a telescope that has played a more recent role in this telescope's life. Herman, you might, can you talk a little bit about sort of how we went about the process about rebuilding the telescope and the Farnham's role in that?
This telescope here was built by Grubb in Dublin in 1883. We have a very good write-up done by one Ian Glass, called Victorian Telescope Makers, which cites throughout the book letters to and from the two Grubbs, that is Thomas the father and Howard the son, and states which telescopes they were building, their discussions with astronomers on new departures in telescope construction. It lists both Grubbs' special ideas on how they could improve on the goods they were, of course, trying to sell. So 1883 was for this telescope. It was by no means the first one Grubb ever did. The first Grubb telescope was around about 1832, I believe, and a somewhat larger one than this one, but because it was so good, it set that firm on its path to build basically just telescopes. And when I say just telescopes, I have to include also eventually certain attachments like spectrographs or perhaps even photographic plate holders at a much later stage. That was Howard by then. But also bigger and bigger telescopes. The aperture fever comes back in again. You know, somebody wrote and says, I have an objective which is that diameter. Can you build me a telescope? And somebody else wrote, but my objective is bigger than yours, and can I have a telescope for that? So it went on and on like that. When we talk about telescopes of this vintage, we talk mainly about refractors. That is, telescopes which employ an objective which comprises usually two lenses. The two lenses are a special development which was made prominent by Dollond in London around about the same time to reduce the achromatic error, the color error, in a single lens system. With two lenses, with different glasses, this can be avoided, and that was really a step in the right direction. People could then look through a telescope and don't see every star blue or every star red, depending on the correction of the
old sometimes lens. Both.
Sometimes both, or most often both. But they could see it essentially without those colored rings around it. So these achromatic objectives had to be produced as well. And Grubb, indeed, had a lovely process going to purchase the glass from somewhere, test it, and as Ian Glass says in his book, often enough rejected some chunks of glass because they weren't good enough. Now, I think nowadays we may have rejected all the chunks of glass which Grubb got because our testing methods have been vastly improved. But at the time, he had tests of clarity of the material, that means no inclusions, little sand particles or so in it. He could test stresses within the glass. He could polish part of it and see if that is readily done, and other similar tests, which in the end produced very good objectives indeed. Where does the glass come from? Well, most of it had to be imported. There is a lovely article, brief article, which talks about the glass tax, which the British government put onto locally produced glasses. So something which stifled the glassmaking industry in England and withered the production of telescope objectives from local makes and shifted all the focus to importation of particular glasses. You could get some from a chappy in Switzerland, you could get some from several people in France, and eventually, by hook or by crook, they ended up in Mr. Grubb's hands, and he produced, by his new developed grinding and polishing methods, very good objectives. And we have, of course, one of those objectives, an Achromat, in this telescope here, and by just general inspection, it looks very good indeed. We had great hopes that we could try the telescopes on the night sky after we had finished the conservation work on it. And we scheduled a particular Wednesday for this. We all turned up and we rolled the telescope out, and so did the clouds as well. So we had to push it back in again because next day it was put in place here. So I must admit, we haven't in earnest looked through the telescope yet on a star. Certainly I've looked at other things and done certain adjustments and so on to make this good to go.
The optics in the Farnham and the Oddy were absolutely magnificent.
Yes.
The Oddy in particular, the 9-inch clone of this, had some of the sharpest optics I've seen in anything. Getting back to double stars again, it could split double stars that were much closer than most other telescopes that size. I think one of the reasons is these things were designed to match the unaided eyeball.
Yep.
Well, they were at the time.
At the time,
yes.
As opposed to now using actual instruments to record data rather than...
Yes, yeah. The telescope is actually equipped especially for double star observations. As Vince pointed out, it is a longish process. One has to acquire the view of the star, do certain measurements, and then do it again and again and again and again, and over years come to some conclusion how do these two stars move around each other and so on. And for that, you can, and also the brightness of those stars and their distance and something which is called the position angle. That is, if you have one star here and one star there, you can measure from some fiducial mark the angle of the line which connects those two stars. It's called the position angle. And the telescope has a micrometer available to be used for that purpose and a position angle rotation at the eyepiece end of the telescope, which is the lower end on the tube, where we found when it was opened up that the beautiful glass scale, which was produced by Grubb at the time, had broken into, well, three major pieces and sort of a small collection of little ones. And the conservation staff at Mitchell put it together again into one piece, and I think that was absolutely wonderful. Trying it out with different cements and different facilities, and careful, don't lift it too hard, you know, it might break again. No, now it's in there. Bingo, we had been winning with that.
Yes.
It might be nice to mention here.
Let's take a question, Dad, before you. Is that okay? Sorry, Herman.
I was listening to your instruction.
I was just saying a question.
I was just going to ask, you raised the point, you know, that was one of the unique things with this telescope. That was one of the unique things with this telescope, that it was designed for double star observation. Were there any other particular things that were put in this telescope and perhaps not some of the others at that time that was, you know, reflected the interest of MacDonald and his observations?
Yes, yes. Nowadays, when we want to buy something, we look at a catalogue. And lo and behold, Mr. MacDonald would have been able to do that as well. We have, as it happens, again through Ian Glass, a copy of the Grubb catalogue of about that vintage. And it lists reflecting telescopes, can be produced in any size up to, I think it was 12 inches or diameter, lens diameter or something like that. And there were two types of telescopes he could select from. type A and type B. Marvelous, isn't it? And he chose type A. And the main difference between the two types was, or still is in fact, that type A, which this one is, has the facility to set the telescope onto an object by merely having to know the sidereal time at the point of observation and the right ascension coordinate of the object you want. Whilst the type B doesn't have this facility, and there you have to know those two data, but you have to do some arithmetic calculation to work out the hour angle and then turn the telescope to the hour angle.
What does that mean? Yes, I come to that. Because I'm confused.
Your chance to make some mistakes straight away. And you find the star should be there, but the telescope says it's there. Well, plus or minus got intermixed there or something like that. So this one here made the observational system procedure much simpler. Now, I've mentioned certain technical names there, which perhaps should be explained.
Yes, please.
If everybody has another half hour, I'd be happy to do so. We live at a place and we have two coordinates, which we call longitude and latitude. And this coordinate system has been also applied to the position of stars in relation to some fiducial lines, which we might not have to go into right now. Only they are not called longitude and latitude, they are called declination and right ascension, or the other way around actually, because longitude is right ascension and latitude is declination. Declination is easy. You just move the telescope up and down until you have the right number, read the right number off the scale, provided, of course, your telescope has initially been set up to coincide with that stellar coordinate system.
Perhaps you should point out
and that is difficult.
Yeah.
Point.
The vital bit that Herman's getting at.
The assistant will.
Yes, unfortunately, I don't have the tights
tutu
and the right sort of shape, but what the heck. The vital bit here is this axle. That axle has to point straight at the pole. It sets this axle parallel to the rotation axis of the Earth. So at Canberra, this angle has to be 35 degrees, 19.3 minutes, roughly. That is Canberra's latitude. If you're on the equator, that axis would be flat. If you're at the pole, it would be pointing straight up. So that is the axle that compensates for the rotation of the Earth. If you drive this axle backwards to the rotation of the Earth, at the same rate the Earth's spinning, the telescope will effectively stay pointed at that spot in the sky. The other one that the Herman's calling declination is this axle, and that lets you move the telescope north and south. So east-west motion around this axle, north-south around that one, declination, right ascension. Sidereal time, I think the only way I ever understood it, was it's time corrected for your latitude. And it gains 3 minutes and 57 seconds on ordinary time every day because the Earth is moving as well in its orbit.
That had to be said. Sidereal time is time measured by against the star or the stars, whilst the normal time we live by is measured against the sun. That means once the Earth has rotated once around and the sun is again in what is called the meridian or a particular point in the sky, that we call 24 hours. If you do the same for a star and you go around once, you find you do it already in 23 hours and 56 minutes, roughly.
Yeah.
So there's roughly 4 minutes difference, and that is because the Earth has rotated part of the way around the sun. And since the astronomers work with stars, well, they have to use this device called sidereal time. So one of the pieces of instrumentation Mr. McDonald acquired fairly early in his observational career was a clock which he could keep to the sidereal time so that he could observe properly. This possibility of setting the telescope without a time-consuming and perhaps erroneous calculation to get the telescope pointing in the right position was one of the Class A-type instrument points in their favor. And McDonald saw that straight away, and it has been commented upon later on by subsequent owners of this particular telescope that this was a great step forward in the right direction. One of the many things which both Thomas and Howard Grubbs devised and built into the telescope. So when I look at this catalog and then compare it with the instruments which we have knowledge of, like this one, the Farnham, and perhaps others as well. There's one in the Science Museum in London and more around the place. It becomes apparent that, yes, there are this specification, but Mr. Grubb said, you know, for a few pounds, I can make this so and so, and it's much better. Well, the astronomer said, excuse me, Mr. Grubb, you couldn't do it this way, and then it is better still. So, and that process still exists nowadays. When the astronomer says, oh, this is the new telescope, can we do so and so with it, you know? Yes, thank you, sir. we don't say, well, yes, this can all be done. Sorry, ma'am, you were going to ask something.
I was actually just thinking when you said just for a few pounds. At the time when this was produced and you said there's a Type A and a Type B, what was the difference in the price for the two and what did they actually sell for?
Before we answer that question, let's ask the audience what they think McDonald paid for this in 1885. Yeah. Have a guess.
Pounds.
How many pounds?
Pounds sterling. To the nearest bidder. And a bid anything.
500?
500 pounds.
50 guineas? How many pounds? How many pounds is 50 guineas? 100 pounds?
No.
50, right. Sorry,
post-1966. We all lose out. Somebody already bid 500 pounds. We should take it away tomorrow, will you? No, the price which we know he paid was £250. And don't forget, he was only a bank manager in a branch of a larger bank. And
they checked the books soon after.
After his family.
What was the salary then, to put it in comparison?
Ah, that's the point. We don't know that.
We think it was around about £40, I think. We're still trying to do some some investigation on that,
yes.
But I think it was probably around about £40,
yes,
so that's a lot of money.
Yes,
that's a year, not a week.
We know, for instance...
What was the difference between A and B? Do we know?
Yes, we know.
In pounds.
Oh, in pounds. we know that too, but unfortunately, the catalogue price list which Grubb offered... It does not list a telescope at £250. It only goes for type B to £170 and for type A, I don't think I have figures. So I can't really compare this. So there is already, if you want that, it will be a little bit more type thing. There may be, of course, cartage included. You know, it might only have been free on board Dublin, and you have to buy the ship to cart it to
Port Macquarie.
pay the rates, you know, to get it to Australia.
We know that he paid £250 because he wrote, when it arrived in Port Macquarie, he wrote a letter to John Tebbutt, who was down near Sydney, to say, oh, I've just bought this wonderful telescope and I paid £250 for it. I often wonder if he regretted that later on, because in the 1890s, around about 1895, he was actually forced to sell the telescope because he got into some deep financial problems. Australia in the 1890s was going through a part of the global financial crisis of the 1890s, and he was forced to sell it, and he sold it for, what was it, 150 pounds. So in 10 years he'd lost 100 pounds on it, which I suspect was not very good news to him.
Good news at all. I happen to know that, again, from old correspondence by Grubb to others, that Grubb paid his good tradesmen, best qualified tradesmen, about 30 to 40 pounds a year to make telescopes. And that is peanuts, we would say today, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm. I think I always think when I look at the photographs of McDonald with his telescope, if you look at this one, and particularly the one around the other side, have a look at it, which is an image of him inside his observatory with the telescope, you'll notice that the telescope's not quite set up for use yet. You can see differences. For example, the strings that attach to the slow motion and so on are not installed. And I rather think, I don't know for sure, but I rather think that photograph was probably taken when the telescope had first arrived in Port Macquarie and McDonald had set it up in his observatory and he thought, man, look at me with my telescope. And I got a travelling photographer who used to travel around the region to come and take a series of photographs of it.
And I claim that he bought himself a new hat when you look at the picture.
That's right. That's
So I think, Kirsten, it's worth mentioning that the drive system in these telescopes is an absolutely fantastic little mechanism.
Yes.
It's a governor, a speed controller that has a couple of spring-loaded balls on arms. As if the telescope tries to go too fast, it spins the balls up a bit and gravity drags them back. If it goes too slow, the balls drop and the springs push them back. It's a marvellous mechanism. The only other place I've seen it, other than in Grubb telescopes, is in old lighthouses. It's exactly the same sort of mechanism that used to spin the lights in lighthouses to keep a nice regular flash. Because the ones in lighthouses revolve a hell of a lot faster than these do.
We have introduced the term drive. That means why do we drive the telescope? Well, if you watch out and observe the sun, you will find it'll rise in the east in the morning and it'll set in the west in the afternoon. It seems to go across the sky, so if we want to look at the sun, or a star for that matter as well, sun is a star, I know, thank you. For any length of time, we have to follow that around across the sky, and that is why the telescope is driven around the right ascension axis, which Vince pointed out a while ago. And why is this so? Well, because the Earth rotates the other way, and you can't just have the Earth stop the Earth. I want to get off, because we would all fall off in any case. So
rather
better
rapidly,
leave things as they were, as they are. So the drive has to be applied to the telescope. Now, how do we do it if we have no posh electric motors with electronic speed controls or anything like that, as we have it nowadays, of course? Well, there is a weight in the central column, in the pedestal of the telescope, suspended from the drive unit by a steel cable. And, of course, if you wind this weight up and you stop, it'll just go plonk down again. And that it doesn't do that, it has the governor, which Vince mentioned, attached to it. And you can see that when you walk around later on, there is a little dial in front with a little needle, and you can move that to the different speed for the telescope to operate at. And whilst this is happening, the weight falls down very, very slowly. And after a while, of course, perhaps 2.5 hours or so, it has reached the bottom. And suddenly you look at the star, and the star goes zoop, and it's gone. And you say, now what's wrong? Oh, the weight fell down. Righto. Then you have to go and wind it up again, reset it all. And that is where later developments to the whole drive system were so much better, because nowadays you don't have to do that anymore, this driving. This winding up of weights and so on.
And Herman, I understand that the pillars of this telescope, which are these kinds of telescope, which are narrow, also make, which are hollow, also make very good houses for possums.
Oh, they do. We had that with the Farnham telescope at Stromlo, which has a very similar arrangement of a central pedestal, and hidden from view here just now around the back, there are some holes, one at the bottom, so that you can see that the weight is down below and you can adjust it and do things like that. But also another hole about 3/4 of the way up, And one night, the observer at the Farnham was winding up the weight and looked to if it had arrived at the upper hole. And instead, he didn't see the weight, but he saw a lovely little possum nose sticking out. The possum had made its house there. So it was being fed apples, and it was left there for a while and then taken away into the...
I've seen the opposite effect on the Abbey. had a very, very, very scared student appear at the 74-inch one night, white as a sheet. They'd been working away and the drive had stopped. And they thought, oh, well, you know, it's, perhaps they, you know, we've hit the end of the travel, but they looked in the middle hole and they could see the pulley there with the rope around it, so they figured the weight hasn't gone down to the bottom yet. So they put the hand in the bottom to see where the weight was, and something warm and furry grabbed and bit. Now, they were down like a shot, you know, trembling. So we went back with the torch and shone the light in. Here's a possum with a, you know, half a hundred weight of lead spread-eagled across the hole and the weight on its back. Says to him, oh, it's easy, you know, it's just a possum caught there. Just wind the weight up, he'll come out. We left him because we knew what would happen. You know what happens when you're standing about, you know, with a hole about here with an irate possum in it, and you've got to stand here to wind the weight up and let him out?
Sorry. I think we had a question over the side there.
Yeah, good evening. I was just wondering whether you had any information on how the telescope would have been transported. Would he have had to do a fair bit of assembly, or it just turns up in a box like that?
No, not in one piece. I sincerely hope. When we shifted it from Mitchell to here... it was suggested that we need a very high truck because of the telescope standing up, and I said, well, the only thing is you turn the tube horizontal. Oh, yes, that is much better. But even then, it is still very bulky, you see. So what I sincerely hope had been done was that the pedestal, which is a jolly heavy piece of equipment and very cumbersome, was separate. Then the whole right ascension and drive unit was by itself, and then the tube was by itself. And then, of course, a box with all lots and lots of little pieces, hopefully all marked A to A, B to B, C to C, so that you could put it together again properly.
Unfortunately, they were all in Swedish, the instructions, so I think that's...
So the bank manager...
Swedish? Pardon me?
So the bank manager probably would have had some skill so he could assemble it.
I should think so. And what's more, if you have a knowledge of telescopes, and Mr. McDonald had this because he had already two or three smaller telescopes previous to the purchase of this one here, he would know the function of various components on those smaller telescopes, and it is relatively easy to enlarge this knowledge by just comparing the smaller example with the newer instrument here. And no doubt Mr. Grubb would have had notes written with it to point out the sequence of assembly. Certainly he has written a paper, which we have a copy of as well, on the adjustment of the telescope itself and its use at night. And that is of importance, that the purchaser, of course, knows what a telescope can do, and not just sort of look through and say, well, this is lovely, but what do I do now? You know, it's not quite in the middle. Which little knob do I turn to adjust all that? So I think that would have been explained.
It's the sort of thing that's never explained in the little telescopes that people tend to buy in toy shops for their kids for Christmas, and thereby spoil any interest the kid will ever have in astronomy. If you intend to buy a telescope at any time, please contact Kaz and talk about it first. There's more traps for young players than there are possum traps in Grubb telescopes.
End of commercial.
I do think it's a very interesting question, actually.
Yes,
how many people from
yes.
the town must have been involved in assembling it?
Yes,
because
yes.
when we put it back together, we actually had to assemble it and then disassemble it again because we didn't quite understand exactly some parts of it and then reassemble it. And, for example, to put the tube on, we used a very large gantry crane to actually be able to pick it up and, you know, actually position it without damaging it while we put it on. And there are, I noticed there are quite a few dents in the tube, which we chose not to repair when we were doing the work on it. We thought that's part of its history, let's leave the dents in. But I do wonder if, as it's been assembled and disassembled through its life, you know, it's had a bit of a rough trot at times. And it does, there is still quite a bit of that history of it, you know, in the telescope itself that we have chosen not to actually repair. Mm. I do imagine, like, sort of everybody in the town having to come down on the night it arrived to help put it
well,
up.
He was, MacDonald was very keen in propagating knowledge of astronomy in a very general sense. He was, as bank manager, a fairly, is important the right word?
I think important.
Notable. Person within Port Macquarie, small as it was perhaps at the time, he was
president of the Pony Club.
President of the Pony Club, the Stewart men know that, and he was instrumental in getting a choral society going, and he did all sorts of these township groups. To get them to get together in the first place and then to further their knowledge of whatever they were doing and enjoy this knowledge.
So plenty of hands to lift the tube.
Yes, if they're tall enough, yes. Of course.
McDonald's standing there giving directions.
Yes, in the new hand. So he would have had enough people to come and knock at the door and say, excuse me, sir, can we perhaps look at this new star up there or whatever, or the moon or and so on. And I think he would have obliged because it was in his way of operating, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions? Oh, one over here, lovely. Wait for the microphone. Quickly, Anne, faster.
Yeah, thanks. You talk about him having used it for binary stars and things, because that's what it was aimed at, designed it for doing specifically. Do we have records of what he was actually observing and so on? I noticed with the information panel you've got there, was it Mr. Beatty then used it and published many scientific papers on it?
Yeah.
And have you actually got information on the other sorts of things and comets and things that MacDonald might have actually observed using this telescope at the time as well?
Mm-hmm. There is a Wayne Orkeston, whose name Kirsty mentioned already before, wrote a nice paper, William John MacDonald and the Development of Astronomy in New South Wales, and in it he quotes the type of observational work which Mr. MacDonald did. And he splits this up into transitory events and into long-term monitoring processes and search programs sort of thing. And you will find, I won't read it all out, but that MacDonald did this is mainly for transitory events. Not solely, but mainly. That means he did not say, in my estimation, start a long-term binary star or double star, if you like, observational program. He was active in looking at comets and no doubt noting their position and brightness and things like that, of course, but not only just sort of look how pretty and then leave it, you know, really do some work with it. But that is a transitory event. The comet comes, the comet goes.
Yeah, he was also a couple of transits of Mercury,
That is another one. Transits of Mercury in front of the disk of the sun. Venus.
Yeah, Port Macquarie was one of the seven New South Wales stations for observing the 1847, wasn't it, transit of Venus? Mm. It was totally clouded out.
Is, of course, the difficulty. If you are part of a group to observe a major event and a transit of Venus or Mercury are major events, at least at the time, to determine the distance to the sun from the Earth. And if it's all cloudy, well, tough luck. But you still have taken part in it. You still have learned how to use the instrumentation. You still have learned how to time these events and to reduce the values afterwards. And it's written elsewhere, not important in this paper, that some of McDonald's timing values of such events were indeed used for the general investigation into the distance between Earth and Sun. There are those eclipses of the moon, eclipses of the sun, lunar occultation of planets, lunar occultations of stars, all transitory events, you will agree, but they can all be noted, they can all be timed, and they can be then made public so that others can, of course, use those data subsequently.
And they're still things that amateurs are very much in the forefront of doing today.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
It's perhaps also a nice kind of point to draw out that a collection like this within the museum is sort of an ongoing project. So even though we've done a lot of work on the telescope already, our understanding about its role in amateur astronomy and the people it was connected with is ongoing. So, for example, one of the projects that's still on the list to do is to go and look at McDonald's observing diaries, which are held up at the Mitchell Library in Sydney, together with a number of his books that he donated at some point. So kind of another next step is to go and again kind of get to know those much better to understand a little bit more again about how he used it. And that's very much part of the museum's work, is to draw together these paper documents with objects like the telescope to understand from the telescope itself what he might have used it for and how he used it and what the way in which the technology itself shaped what he could do.
Just getting back to your question about, you know, did anything, you know, long-term on double stars come out of it? McDonald mightn't have done much, but one of the guys that bought the telescope later on was very much into double stars and binaries, Innes. He actually wrote several of the papers that set up the sort of physical investigation of double stars. He bought the telescope. He would definitely have used it for a long-term double star program, but he got offered a job at the observatory at Cape Town and shot through to there, so he never actually got round to using the telescope. But it came close.
You mentioned that others have used the telescope. This is quite correct. Kirsty said that William McDonald had to sell the instrument and others in his stable of astronomical instrumentation because of financial difficulties brought upon by the general times in the 1890s order off. And McDonald had all told, I have written down here, 6 refractors and one transit instrument to determine the position of Port Macquarie, as it were, precisely, and the timing as well, and so on. And of those, he kept only 2 instruments and took them with him to Sydney, and this was not one of them. So this telescope here in particular was then sold to Mr. Innes, who almost immediately sold it on to Mr. Gale, who then sold it on to Mr. Beattie. And there we start now a long use of the telescope, a period of long use of the telescope, and we have one picture where Beattie stands next to the telescope with an attachment on it, which we can't entirely decipher what it is, but I think it is a very early type of photographic plate holder. for the instrument.
I guess Gale would have used this telescope to do some observations of at least one of the four comets that he discovered.
Yes, yes. Then it Beatty soldered onto one Hoskins, who soldered onto one Blims, who soldered onto one Otto, who put it into the shed, and then Mr. Benson discovered it, and now we got it. And are we pleased?
An eventful life.
Yes, the trouble is that because of all this, of all these personal difficulties, which made it necessary to sell on the instrument, which after all is a very useful and fairly expensive device, the telescope was not used as much as it could have been used had it been in one owner, well, not all 150 years, but for extensive times, unfortunately. And of course, every time you sell it, you know, oh, I take it to there and there, it's taken to pieces, it is packed onto a horse dray, it is carted across around the corner.
Another two dents, another bit lost.
And those dents we have left.
Yep.
We didn't want to polish them all out and really make it look Grubb Parsons untouched by human hands type affair.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm conscious it's coming up to 7 o'clock. If we've got another question, we've certainly got time. Wait for the microphone.
Has anyone actually checked the sky?
We are just warming up, you know, aren't we? Sorry, ma'am.
This question is very peripheral, but I wonder whether for a layperson, maybe Vince, could just briefly explain how the sailors, the seafarers, used to use the stars to navigate around the world.
Yes.
First thing you need...
related to what...
First thing that you needed, of course, was a very good set of star positions. Now, they didn't need the whole sky, although eventually, you know, everything that was at least visible to the eyeball was the position was noted in those two coordinates Herman mentioned, right ascension and declination. So you had a grid over your head that you knew the position of certain stars. You then needed to measure from the deck of your sailing ship at a known time the what we call the azimuth, the sort of from the north point round through the east, that angle to the star, and its altitude, how far it was above the horizon. So you'd get your sextant and your compass out and you'd measure those two angles. Then you'd go to a set of tables and try and figure out, you know, I know the position of the star, I know the time, I know the angle it is from where I am, where am I? It was a batch of mathematics, simple trig. The simplest way of doing it was the way that the Polynesians and a lot of other, the Arabs, a lot of old ancient mariners did. Simplest way is, okay, you know, for example, this star has got a declination of minus 35 degrees, 19 minutes. That means it goes right overhead at Canberra. So I'm in my sailing ship and I'm trying to find Canberra. You'd find the last couple of hundred kilometres a bit rough, but what the heck. So what you do is you start off from England and you sail due south, due south, due south, until that star at 3519.3 is directly over the top of your mast as it goes across the sky and as it's the highest point in the sky. You know then your latitude is minus 35 degrees, etc. So then, knowing that England is a hell of a long way west of Australia, you turn your sailing ship east, you sail due east, and eventually if you can get your ship through Western Australia, South Australia and most of New South Wales, you'll end up at Canberra. That was the simplest method of doing it. The Polynesians, for example, knew that Altair went straight overhead in Hawaii, so when they left Tahiti, they'd go north, and Altair went straight over the top at its highest, then they'd turn east and sail down. Gets a lot more complicated after that. The next step is to find out where your longitude actually is. Latitude's simple. You know how far the star is north or south of the equator. You measure the angle. The difference in angle will tell you where you are in latitude, north or south of the equator. Longitude, you need to know the time. You need to know the time very accurately. And that's what held up accurate navigation for centuries. It wasn't until really accurate clocks came along that you could get your longitude safely enough to know which side of Australia you're on, for example.
They're called chronometers.
Chronometers, yeah. But it's just a question of star position, angles measured from your boat, and the time, and a good set of tables.
And nowadays you use satellites, don't you?
That's right. GPS, bring it on.
GPS.
The satellites, to know where they are, need a good set of star positions,
yeah,
accurate timing.
That's right. So we're back where we started.
So we're back where we started from. Yeah.
Let's have one more question.
We have time, haven't we?
Thank you. Perhaps coming back to the museum and perhaps stepping away from this, can I just ask what other artefacts you might have at all related to amateur astronomy or to the study of the stars here? You know, is this the only thing in the collection, or do you actually have a pool of other things as well?
I'm sorry to report that this is our sole object relating to amateur astronomy. It was actually a big basis upon which I argued that we should purchase the collection, which was a fairly significant investment for the museum, both in the initial purchase and then obviously in a long-term conservation project. I am hopeful that it may be the beginning of a collection, but so far the museum hasn't really acquired a lot of material relating to amateur astronomy, or indeed that much material relating to what we might call professional astronomy. Institutions like the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, as certainly part of Sydney Observatory, obviously have a very good collection around Sydney Observatory, and the Melbourne Museum has a very good collection, including material from Mount Stromlo, which has found its way back to there. I think the area of astronomical material that we do have that's quite good is actually, which is sort of maybe a bit set kind of to the side of our discussion this evening, but is collections of Bart paintings that really talk about Aboriginal astronomy. We obviously have a very large Bart painting collection, and I think there's a lot of information in there that in some way still has to be investigated and researched about the significance of understanding the night sky for Aboriginal people.
That comes back to navigation again. You needed to know where you were on the face of the earth as well, because if you were an Aboriginal who wandered into the wrong tribal area, you were dead.
Absolutely. You might know that Grubb Parsons, or Grubb rather, built also the great Melbourne reflector. Now we talk reflectors, not refractor, for that one. And that was the 48-inch at the time, later on the 50-inch, or as I would have it, 1.2-metre reflecting telescope, which was at Mount Stromlo, which got burned out. And now the remnants, those remnants which date back to 1868, when the great Melbourne telescope was being built by Grubb, have found their way back to Melbourne, and the people there promise to make a concerted effort to rebuild that telescope. That will take them a while, and it'll take them more than £250.
Right.
They're just trying to keep up with us, it's okay.
Yeah, no, not really.
There's another question here, no, and then here.
Sorry, mine's a really quick question. How much does it weigh? I was just thinking about the assembly before, and how much did the museum purchase it for today?
Can you talk about weight?
I can mention the weight. It's easily measured by using a forklift which has a little gadget on it, and it says you are now lifting 923 kilograms. A third of that is in the pedestal, if not more. It's good, solid, old cast iron, you know, battleship-type stuff. Grubb, before he started into telescopes, made cast iron stands for billiard tables in his factory at Dublin. And he began to become interested in telescopes about 1832, I think, something like that. And in the end, he chucked the builder's tables out, and he only built telescopes, you know. But so he's used to heavy castings, as it were, and you can see not only heavy, but also precise castings, because you will find that some gearing in this telescope as well are actually cast pieces, and not like we would do them today, you know, with high-precision grinding machines to produce those gears. There are other points in it which interest me, because how well in those days, 1883, can you produce a gear which has a precise spacing between the teeth, and I mean precise, down to thousandths of an inch, or perhaps hundredths of a millimeter, as we would say nowadays. And he managed that. And there is correspondence between him and astronomers using his telescopes, where it is recorded how well the drive, and all these gears are part of the driving system for the telescope, are actually behaving. If you look through the telescope just with your unaided eye, and you see the star, now if it moves a tiny fraction to one side or the other side, you won't even notice that. But if you now use photography, that is entirely different. You have the photographic plate, the star image falls onto it, and it sends it creates an image on this photographic plate. Now, if the star moves, this image will move sideways or up or down or higgledy-piggledy all around the place. And then when you develop it, you say, well, that doesn't look a bit like I can see with my eye directly. And that is due to drive difficulties, and they had to be overcome. And Grubb has later on, way after this telescope was built here, produced electrical control methods now to steady the drive and to improve on the gear behavior and to reduce backlash and have the spacing accurate to a very high degree, which would bring the price up, admittedly, but it certainly would have improved the dependability and the accuracy of the operating telescope very much indeed.
One thing you'll notice when you go out to look at the sky is most of the telescopes you're using won't look like this.
No.
These refractors that use lenses are not the way most telescopes are built these days. The main part of the telescope is the mirror. Why mirrors? Well, point one, you can't make a lens bigger than about that and have it keep its shape. Lenses have to be supported around their edges, around their weakest point. So as the angle you're looking through them changes, as you point your telescope around the sky, the lens sags, distorts, and your image goes worse than what Herman was just describing. Mirrors, you can support them across the background, the side, they're a nice solid thing. And you can make mirrors up to about 8.5 metres in diameter if you're so concerned. If you want to go bigger than that, you just make lots of hexagonal 8.5 metre mirrors and mosaic them together. There's telescopes in action now with mirrors 10 metres in diameter, and one's planned with mirrors up to 30 metres in diameter. Lenses, you pass light through a lens, you lose, as the light goes from the air into the glass and the glass out into the air, you can lose anywhere between 7 and 10% of the light, or in the case of that particular lens, anything up to 50% of the light. That's not good for astronomy, where you're trying to get every little bit of light you can. But a nice clean mirror reflects 98% of the light that hits it. So pretty well all telescopes these days use mirrors instead of lenses. Kimbo, what's the sky like? It's clear. So I suggest that as there's a batch of these telescopes waiting for you, that you get them before the cloud comes back.
I want to say something else.
Just before we go,
please.
Sorry, is it more information or is it?
No, please note that unfortunately we have no member of the conservation team here tonight. And I would like to put on record my appreciation of their expertise and their willingness to work together with me, and I with them, to get this telescope in this particular shape it is now, which I believe is about the best renovated telescope in the world.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.